Blog Talk Radio.
Democratic Values with your hosts, Jerry Williams and Paula Alexander. Right now, let's give a warm welcome from the man from Cincinnati, Ohio, and a former police officer, Jerry Williams.
Hi, welcome to the show. This is your host, Jerry Williams. And this is Democratic Values. We are going to kind of talk about some of the basic brief news stories today. That's why I'm doing a very short show today. And Paula Alexander obviously is off tonight because she is probably sleeping right now. I figured I would do a really short show for you today. Kind of give you some ideas of what's going on in the breaking news. So here's what we do know, as we have everything that's been going on in this world. What bothers me is some of the stupid shit that has been happening with the Democratic or with the Republican Party, not realizing to concede this election. I have no clue why they will not concede this election. It really is something that kind of bothers me a little bit, because nobody, this is the way they are. They want to try to think that they can just continue this this march. And what's really amazing is that there is no room. They've tried everything possible to try to overturn this election, but it's not going to happen. Joe Biden has won the election. So they're going to have to face the facts that there is no voter fraud. There has not been any kind of voter tampering, voter anything for that matter, except for everybody's votes were legal and they accounted. So there was no voter fraud. Here's what we do know. Donald Trump will not concede the election because he has to feel that he has been cheated from this whole thing. And the reason why we realize why Trump is really getting crazy the way he is, because Donald Trump has a lot of issues here. So Donald Trump is the luckiest man alive, as a matter of fact. Unlike almost, well, everyone, he's been protected from the consequences of his own mistakes in his entire life. Born into a wealthy family, he was insulated from the lukewarm academic prospects and serial business crackups by his father's money. I often say that I'm a member of the Lucky Sperm Club. It is how he put it in one of his books. Emerging as a reality TV star in the early 2000s, Trump discovered that fame allowed him to be a predatory, pleased without repercussions. When you're a star, they can let you do whatever you want. As he said in a 2016 accent at the White House, opened the eyes to the presidency legal armor, which interpreted broadly and often inaccurately. I have an Article 2 where I have the rights to do whatever I want as president, Donald Trump said. Although Trump has struggled throughout the years, and he has juggled many, many times with difficulties of yo-hum grades, his personal bankruptcy, his sexual assault accusations, federal investigations, and even an impeachment, he has plowed through ahead relatively unwounded and unencumbered by the regret. Wealth, celebrity, and the presidency have kept him buoyant. All that insulation has also meant that he has learned from his mistakes. Even personal and public reckoning has been postponed or shunt aside. Now, however, Trump is starting, staring at the threats, especially two threats that loom after he leaves the White House in January. One is financial, the other is legal. Neither in the entirely under his control, and both may help explain, along with his perennial inability to accept losing, why Trump won't acknowledge that President-elect Joe Biden is going to succeed him, and why he has enlisted the Republican Party to help him gaslight Americans about the outcome of the presidential election. You know, Trump has been really, truly a traitor in this. Trump in the patchworks of businesses he houses inside the Trump Organization are saddled with more than $1 billion in debt, which Dan Alexander of Forbes has helped tailor on this. A portion of the total has been divulged over a past few years in the president's personal finance disclosures on file with the Office of Government Ethics. The New York Times recently revealed that the Trump has personally guaranteed at least $421 million of debt, with more than $300 million coming due within 4 years. In other words, Trump is on the hook for a lot of money that he may have to scramble to repay in the COVID-19 battered economy. And with his industries, hotels, leisure, urban real estate have been particular plummeted. Forbes estimates his assets are worth $3.7 billion. Bloomberg News pegs that it's about $3.2 billion. He's not going broke, but if the economy continues to struggle in the coming months, those validations will be tested. And much of that Trump holds is liquid, meaning that it may be hard pressed to sell assets quickly if he needs to raise funds. Trump's most valuable holdings, for example, are minority stakes in two properties controlled by the Vornado Realty Trust, and rumors of fire sales that might the value of the portfolio. In his legal battles, the Manhattan District Attorney's Office is investigating Trump for possible tax fraud and falsification of business records. And according to the appellate court findings in this probe, which is also examining the president's payment of hush money to two women whom he allegedly had sexual encounters with him, the DA's office is seeking 8 years of Trump's tax returns. It is also taking a look at whether Trump inflated the value of his properties and other assets in order to secure funds from lenders and investors. New York Attorney General Lita James has launched another investigation also focused on whether Trump's organizations and Trump family manipulated valuations to secure funding or engineer tax benefits. James' probe is a civil case which could bring hefty financial penalties against Trump, but no prison time, unless she finds reasons to recast as the criminal case. Manson's investigation is a criminal matter. However, if the Trump crew is found guilty of felonies, prison time is on the table. These are many obstructions and of course, violations that Trump is facing when he leaves the White House. The problem is that's why Donald Trump is trying not to leave the White House and is claiming voter fraud and trying to say this was a rigged election because he knows he's in trouble once he leaves the White House. And if we remember that Donald Trump encouraged people in North Carolina that he told them to vote twice, if you remember. Voting twice and actually constitutes voter fraud, the president has railed against. Mr. Trump made the comment on briefing reporters of voting twice, but yet he is saying that there is voter fraud on the Democratic side. When this man has said to the point of saying, let's vote twice to his people, his supporters. This is a problem of where it lies. If anybody had any kind of voter fraud or anything of that magnitude, which there is none, by the way, then it could be on the Trump side of people that did it, only because of what they were encouraged to do for the whole thing here, for Trump is what they were doing. So there's so much that's happening in this that we need to really be paying attention to. And, there was another tweet that came out about Donald J. Trump. It says another vaccine just announced the time by Moderna, 95% effective for those great historians. Please remember that these great discoveries, which will end the China plague, all took place on my watch. And it didn't take long. I knew there would be a tweet on this that would come along with taking credit. It is a fantastic news that we potentially have a vaccine. This is what Trump said. Isn't it crazy that they do this? And by the way, so the Trump supporters, the Million MAGA March that took place yesterday in Washington, D.C., was a staggering display of the stupidity and racism and the complete denial of reality of the course that kind of behavior is expected from Trump's death cult. But there was one moment that blew our collective minds. Among the protesters were two people in costume, one dressed as Joe Biden, in a prisoner uniform being held by another man wearing a Trump mask while dressed as Homelander from The Boys. If you remember, that the Homelander from The Boys, by the way, is a villain. He's not anything good. He's a villain. And of course, they wore this outfit and they did not even understand what it was about. That just tells you the stupidity of these Trump supporters and what they do. It just blows my mind how they think. I mean, I don't even know what they think. I think their brains don't work too good when it comes to some of this stuff. I mean, seriously, people. And, Trump's failure to work with Biden is becoming more urgent as COVID spreads. President Donald Trump is facing a barrage of calls to permit potentially life-saving transition talks between his health officials and incoming President-elect Joe Biden's aides. On a fast worsening pandemic, he is continuing to ignore in his obsessive efforts to discredit an election that he clearly lost. The increasingly urgent pleas are coming from inside his administration, the president-elect's team, and independent public health experts as COVID-19 cases rage out of control countrywide, claiming more than 1,000 U.S. lives a day. More than 246,000 Americans have now died from the disease, and a bitter winter lies ahead, even amid encouraging news such as Monday's announcement that a vaccine developed by Moderna is a demonstrating high success rate. It is early clinical trials, second such positive vaccine news in about a week. But instead of listening to the mobilization to tackle, and some medical experts are warned in becoming a humanitarian crisis, Trump spent the weekend, during which the U.S. passed 11 million infections, amplifying lies and misinformation about his election loss. At one point, he appeared to acknowledge Sunday in a tweet that Joe Biden won the election before backtracking with a stream of defiance on Twitter. So this came as the nation's top infectious disease expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci, said on CNN's State of the Union Sunday that, of course, it will be better if we could start working with the Biden team that will take office on January 20th. As you know, Donald Trump is still denying the fact that Joe Biden has won this election. And Donald Trump is asking for his advisors for options to attack Iran's main nuclear site just days after sacking his defense secretary. I mean, what has he done here? He got rid of his defense secretary, and now President Donald Trump is asking senior advisors to provide him with options for a military strike on Iran last Thursday. And according to the New York Times, an array of top advisors persuaded Trump against pursuing such a strike with such a short time left in his presidency, warning that the move could spark a broader conflict. Trump pushed the U.S. And Iran to the brink of war at the beginning of 2020. President Donald Trump last week consulted with top advisors on potential options for a military strike on Iran's main nuclear site, as the New York Times reported on Monday. But senior advisors ultimately discouraged Trump from persuading or pursuing into the strike, of arguing that such a move could spiral into a larger conflict with the short time remaining as president. Tenure for current and former officials told the Times that Trump has refused to accept the results of the concede. President-elect Joe Biden defeated him in the 2020 election. So here we are. We're in a situation where we could be going to another serious war. And with that said, Donald Trump has been doing some really crazy shit here by, you know, eliminating he's eliminating his defense attorneys. He's losing staff. He's getting rid of them. And it's becoming even more clear that it's becoming more dangerous than what Donald Trump's doing. And it's important that we have a transition for security reasons. But, you know, Donald Trump is not wanting to do this because Donald Trump is never going to be on the same page as everybody else. And, of course, this is where it becomes dangerous when you're not working together, trying to help bring anything together. It's so important. And in Secretary Lindsey Graham, did you hear what he said? Yeah, he said this. The Georgia Secretary of State is saying now that Lindsey Graham is suggesting that he finds a way to toss legal balance in Georgia. Lindsey Graham is asking them to find the legal ballots in Georgia and toss them, mail-in ballots. Do you know how stupid that is? That they want to sink this low to try to get in, you know, to win an election. I just blows my fucking mind that they would even say that. That's how stupid they are. Well, I don't think it's going to happen, though, because, you know, people are more smarter than that. You know, they know what to do here. But when Donald Trump wanted to talk about cheating, Donald Trump is the one who cheats, right? Again, he said to his supporters in North Carolina, vote twice, right? You remember this? Well, that's why this bothers me, because he said vote twice. Here's what he said.
They had some interesting polls. I don't know. Do I like it or don't I like it? I guess I probably do. But they say no matter what it is, there are more votes for Trump. Because a lot of people say, just leave me alone. I'm going to vote the way I want to vote. And then they go into their vote for Trump. On your ballots, if you get the unsolicited ballots, send it in and then go make sure it counted. And if it doesn't tabulate, you vote. You just vote. And then if they tabulate it very late, which they shouldn't be doing, they'll see you voted and so it won't count. So send it in early and then go and vote. And if it's not tabulated, you vote. And the vote is going to count. You can't let them take your vote away. These people are playing dirty politics. Dirty politics. So if you have an absentee ballot, or as I call it, a solicited ballot, you send it in. But I would check it in any event. I would go and follow it and go vote. And everybody here wants to vote. We vote the old-fashioned way. You know, we voted in World War I. We voted in World War II. We're going to see some great World War II heroes right now. But we voted in World War II. And today they want to give everybody ballots. And every place where they've done it, it's been a mess. It's been a mess. They don't know where they are. They don't know who they're sending them to. It's a terrible thing. Follow your ballot and vote. It's very important. I think everybody understands. Take care, North Carolina. We have to win it big. So we just got a poll. We're up 7 in Georgia. We're up a lot everywhere. I think a lot everywhere.
And, of course, Donald Trump, you know, he was telling people to vote twice in that rally. You can clearly hear Donald Trump say, vote twice. This is what I'm talking about. When it comes to election fraud, if any kind of election fraud was to ever happen, which it has not, then we have to look at Donald Trump. Because he was promoting this for the longest time, trying to set up the whole thing and saying it's election fraud. This is election fraud, people. It's going to happen. We're going to see election fraud everywhere. Election fraud, election fraud, election fraud. If you start to promote this, eventually people are going to buy into it like his supporters. That's why Donald Trump kept saying this over and over, voter fraud, it's election fraud, they're trying to steal the election. We've heard Donald Trump say this in 2016. We've heard him say it in the primaries in 2016. With Hillary Clinton, the 2018, and now 2020. His own Department of Homeland Security came out and said this was the most secured election ever in U.S. history, this election. The most secured election. Now, that's what we have here, folks. If they said that it's the most secured election, I have to tell you, why would they want to lie to you? Because, you know, Donald Trump is wanting to say this? Come on. And here's an audio I want to play. It's Robert Reich, who talks about Trump's post-election. You know, he is a reporter and a communist, not communist, retract. He's a columnist is what I was looking for. He was talking about the lies of Donald Trump of the post-election. Here's what he said.
Even though Joe Biden won the highest percentage of the popular vote for any challenger since FDR in 1932, the Trump campaign is fighting in courtrooms across the country in a desperate attempt to overturn the results. So far, they've been utterly unsuccessful. Why? They have no evidence to back up their claims of widespread voter fraud. Here's a brief debunking of some of the baseless claims Trump and his lackeys are promoting in key swing states. In Pennsylvania, a postal worker who alleged he saw a postmaster instruct postal workers to backdate ballots mailed after Election Day walked back his allegations when questioned by federal investigators. In a recording of his interview, the postal worker can be heard admitting he made assumptions based on snippets of a conversation he overheard and declined to stand by his original statement. And in a court case filed in the state, the Trump campaign claimed that Republican poll watchers had been barred from watching vote counts in Philadelphia. That was a lie. One of Trump's attorneys admitted in court that the campaign did, in fact, have people in the room. In Michigan, Trump supporters circulated a list of over 14,000 voters who are supposedly dead but cast ballots for Joe Biden. CNN ran a random sample analysis of 50 of the names and found no instance of a dead person voting. They also have tried to bolster their claim by circulating videos showing voters who have birth dates in January 1900 returning ballots, but Detroit's director of elections explained that the date of January 1st, 1900 is often used as a temporary placeholder for absentee ballots arriving just before Election Day. That's information that has to be inserted in order for the electronic poll book to accept the entry. Down in Georgia, false rumors of ballots being found in a dumpster behind the Spalding County Election Office circulated widely, but an investigation from the Sheriff's Office found that no ballots were found in the dumpster, and that conclusion was affirmed by the Secretary of State's office. In Arizona, claims that the use of Sharpie markers on ballots would result in them being tossed sparked a flimsy lawsuit, but the Maricopa County Board of Elections, the State Director of Elections, and the State Attorney General all confirmed that the use of Sharpies did not result in disenfranchisement. In Nevada, Trump campaign lawyers claimed they had evidence of criminal voter fraud because some Nevadans had voted from out of state. In fact, the voters in question included military service members and their families.
We take our duties as citizens very seriously, and it was just a shock to see that this accusation had been made without any basis in fact.
As well as students and congressional staffers who moved out of the state within 30 days of the election, all of whom are legally allowed to cast a vote in Nevada. And the New York Times reached out to top election officials in every state, and all said they found no evidence of widespread voter fraud. Make no mistake, Trump and his lackeys have no standing to change the outcome of the election. But with GOP leaders pushing his lies, nearly half the country is coming to believe the election was stolen, and that is almost as dangerous. Joe Biden will be our next president, but we need to aggressively knock down every baseless claim made by Trump and the GOP to defend not just Biden's victory, but also the trust on which American democracy is based.
And there you go. So the whole thing that you see, or you try to realize that, well, the whole base claims that Donald Trump says that there's election fraud is totally, it's totally irresponsible on his part to say this. If he would just act like a real human being, this could be resolved and we can have a smooth transition like every other presidency. All right, this is Democratic Values. I'm Jerry Williams. We're going to take a break. When we come back from the break, we'll talk more about what's happening in the news and what's happening currently as we speak. And it's 4:34 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, and we'll be right back in just a few moments right here on Democratic Values.
Good evening. Ella Baker, a giant of the civil rights movement, left us with this wisdom. Give people light, and they will find the way. Give people light. Those are words for our time. Just a week ago yesterday was the third anniversary of the intervention in Charlottesville. Close your eyes. Remember what you saw on television. Remember seeing those neo-Nazis. Remember seeing those Klansmen coming out of the field with lighted torches, veins bulging, spewing the same anti-Semitic bile heard across Europe in the 30s. Remember the violent clash that ensued between those spreading hate and those with the courage to stand against it. Remember what the president said when asked? He said there were, quote, very fine people on both sides. It was a wake-up call for us as a country. And for me, a call to action.
People killing, people dying, children hurt and you hear them crying. Can you practice what you preach? And would you turn the other cheek? Father, 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 help us. Send some guidance from above. These people got me questioning. Where is the love?
What's wrong with the world, mama? People living like they ain't got no mamas. I think the whole world's addicted to the drama. Only attracted to things that bring the trauma. Overseas, yeah, we trying to stop terrorism. But we still got terrorists here living. In the USA, the KKK. I can't believe they're still hating blacks today. Cause if you only have love for your own race, then you only leave space to discriminate. And to discriminate only generates hate. And when you hate, then you're bound to get irate. Yeah, madness is what you demonstrate. And that's exactly how hate works and operates. Man, you gotta have love if you set it straight. Take control of your mind and meditate. Let your soul gravitate to the love.
People killing, people dying, children hurt and you hear them crying. Can you practice what you preach? And would you turn the other cheek? Father, 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 help us. Send some guidance from above. These people got me questioning. Where is the love? The love.
For us is simple. Are we ready? I believe we are. We must be. We can choose a path of becoming angrier, less hopeful, more divided, a path of shadow and suspicion, or we can choose a different path and together take this chance to heal, to reform, to unite, a path of hope and light. This is a life-changing election. This will determine what America is going to look like for a long, long time.
Yes, it is.
Character is on the ballot. Compassion is on the ballot. Decency, science, democracy.
Yeah.
They're all on the ballot. Who we are as a nation. What we stand for. Most importantly, who we want to be. That's all on the ballot. And the choice could not be more clear.
Announcing Arby's Holiday 5 for $5.55 deal. Get five delicious slow roasted regular roast beef sandwiches for just $5.55. We'll even gift wrap them.
I thought it was five golden rings.
It says roast beef sandwiches.
That's the way I remember.
I kind of like the change.
But hurry, Arby's Holiday 5 for $5.55 deal ends soon.
I have a structured settlement and I need cash now.
Call J.G. Wentworth, 877 cash now.
They'll help thousands, they'll help you too.
What?
877 Cash Now.
It's your money. Use it when you need it.
OJ Wentworth, 877 Cash Now.
You think Santa will like these red and green M&Ms?
I don't know. I never met the guy.
He does exist.
I do exist. Santa?
These little cups would make great stocking stuffers. But how about right now in your mouth stuffers? Happy holidays to your mouth. Not sorry. Reese's.
This Christmas, Taco Bell would like to propose a traditional holiday feast. To start, a delicious main course filled with your favorite stuffing. A special side dish made from an old family recipe. For your sweet tooth, a festive holiday treat. All topped off by a bit of the bubbly. And what better way to finish an old-fashioned Christmas meal than with a rousing chorus of your favorite holiday tune?
This is CNN Breaking News.
It's time to check all the latest news right now with Democratic Values and CNN. And today, Joe Biden came out and spoke today. He said he did a press conference. Then came out and spoke about the economy and what he wanted to do for the economy and what he wanted to do as far as trying to get the economy back on track. So we're seeing the difference between the president who is trying to run away from election fraud and thinking that the election is still being counted versus Joe Biden, who is moving forward and is preparing our country for the transition where he takes oath of office in January 20th, 2021. This is the difference in what we're seeing with these two leaders and what they're, you know, what they're about. So Joe Biden did come out. He did speak pertaining to this same scenario and what he was going to do with the economy. Now, he's already came out and talked about COVID-19 and his plans for the transition team of COVID-19. And like we said, he came out and he spoke today. One thing that we've realized is with Joe Biden speaking, he's giving pretty much all the details of what's going to take place in America as he moves forward for a better country for all of us. And so I think that that's really what's nice is to hear Joe Biden come out and speak about the economy. This audio is Joe Biden speaking about the economy, and here is what he had to say.
We had an important conversation about the impact that this pandemic has had on workers, especially essential workers, frontline workers, who have risked their own health and the health of their families, and many whom have given their own lives to keep us safe and keep our economy running. And we all know that this pandemic and this recession have hit communities of color particularly hard. Black Americans and Latinos are three times as likely to contract COVID as others and more likely to die. Native Americans are more than four times as likely to be hospitalized as others. And last month, the unemployment rate for Black Americans was almost twice the rate of others. And we have also had a conversation about the impact this pandemic has had on our economy as a whole, from the Fortune 500 to the small businesses that so many communities rely on. Over the past few months, on the campaign trail, the president-elect and I saw that impact firsthand. In state after state, we met with workers who shared their struggles and told us about their pain. Essential workers who've had to stay on the job, even as they worry about their family's well-being and their own. Small business owners who are dipping into their own savings to make payroll and keep their doors open. And many others who have had to close their doors and fear never reopening at all. Their stories have stayed with us. And the president-elect and I are focused on building our country back better for them and all Americans. And as I said the night we won this election, now is when the real work begins, the necessary work, the good work of getting this virus under control, saving lives, and beating this pandemic, and opening our economy responsibly while rebuilding it so that it works for working people. And we will do it by protecting the health and safety of our workers and creating millions of good-paying union jobs, from auto and construction jobs to domestic workers and caregiving jobs to service and hospitality jobs. The road ahead, it will not be easy, but the president-elect and I are hitting the ground running because we all know the challenges facing America today are great. The American people deserve no less, and we don't have a moment to waste. And now it is my incredible and great honor to introduce our president-elect, Joe Biden.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Vice President Harris and I. As she indicated, just met with a group of America's top business leaders and labor leaders. And I must tell you, it reinforced what I thought from the beginning. We're ready to come together. The unity was astounding. I want to go back and talk about the people who actually participated in that. I'm going to list all the people who, you, just so you know who we spoke with. Number one, there was Mary Barra, CEO of General Motors, Brian Cornell, CEO of Target, Mr. Nadell, CEO of Microsoft, Rory Gamble, President of the UAW, Mary Kay Henry, President of SEIU, Mark Perrone, President of UFCW, Lee Saunders, President of AFSCME, and Sonia Single, President of Gap, Richard Trumka, President of the AFL-CIO. It was really encouraging, quite frankly, to get people, business and labor, together agreeing on the way forward, which I'm convinced the American people will be ready to do when they hear what we have in mind. And I'm very pleased that they all came together around the same table to advance areas of common ground, and we agreed we're going to continue these conversations. They represent very different perspectives, but I'm convinced that we can all come together around the same table to advance areas of common ground, which are really, I wish you could have all heard the conversation. It was really encouraging. And that's what we were ready to discuss today. We all agreed that we want to get the economy back on track. We need our workers to be back on the job by getting the virus under control. We're going in a very dark winter. Things are going to get much tougher before they get easier. And that requires sparing no effort to fight COVID so that we can open our businesses safely, resume our lives, and put this pandemic behind us. It's going to be difficult, but it can be done. And they all agreed that means rallying the country behind a national strategy with robust public health measures like mandatory masking, widely available testing with rapid results, scaled up production of life-saving treatments and therapeutics, and safe, equitable, and free distribution of the vaccine. It's great news that Moderna and Pfizer have each come up with vaccines that are in excess of 90% effectiveness. And getting a vaccine and a vaccination, though, are two different things. Everyone on our call today and our Zoom today agreed that the sooner we have access to the administration's distribution plan, the sooner this transition would be smoothly moved forward. And, you know, as we battle COVID, we also make sure the business and workers have the tools, the resources, the national guidance, and health and safety standards to operate safely. And we can do that. We can bring Democrats and Republicans together, work with business and labor to deliver those necessary resources. And for millions of Americans who've lost hours and wages or have lost their jobs, we all agree on our call that we can deliver immediate relief and it need be done quickly. Affordable health care for millions of people who have lost it or are in danger of losing it. Child care, sick leave, family leave, so workers don't have to choose between work and family. Corporate America agreed on this today. The folks on the call. We need support of small to support small businesses and entrepreneurs that are the backbone of our communities, but are teetering on the edge. And we all agreed on the urgent need for funding for states and localities to keep frontline workers and essential workers on the job. Vital public services, running law enforcement offices, educators, first responders, like we did in the Recovery Act of 2009, saving literally millions of jobs. There's a reason why the federal government is able to run a deficit, because the states must balance their budgets, and they're in real trouble. You're going to see hundreds of thousands of police officers, firefighters, first responders, mental health clinics. You're going to see them going out of business. Right now, Congress should come together and pass a COVID relief package like the HEROES Act that the House passed 6 months ago. Once we shut down the virus and deliver economic relief to workers and businesses, then we can start to build back better than before. We talked about how we have an opportunity to come out of this stronger, more resilient than we were when we went in. And I wish you could have heard corporate leaders and the major labor leaders singing from the same hymnal here. Throughout the campaign, I laid out my Build Back Better plan. We laid out our plan. That an independent analysis put out by Moody's, a well-respected Wall Street firm, projected it would create 18.6 million jobs. We talked about the need to own the electric vehicle market. We talked about climate a lot, building 550,000 charging stations, creating over 1 million good-paying union jobs here at home, the need for a federal government to invest more in clean energy research. You know, it's based on a simple premise. It's time to reward work, not just wealth in America. We're going to have a fair tax structure that makes sure the wealthiest among us and corporations pay their fair share. Our plan will create millions of good-paying union jobs in manufacturing, building the vehicles, products, technologies that we're going to need for the future to compete with the rest of the world. From autos to our stockpiles, we're going to buy American. No government contract will be given to companies that don't make their products here in America. To secure our position as a global leader in research and development, we're going to invest $300 billion in the most critical, competitive new industries and technologies, creating 3 million good-paying jobs. And the corporate American technology firms like Microsoft on the call, they all agreed. We can make sure our future is made here in America. And that's good for business, and it's good for American workers. We can also modernize our infrastructure, roads, bridges, ports, 1.5 million new affordable housing units, high-speed broadband we talked about, for every American household, which is more important than ever for remote learning, remote working, telemedicine in the 21st century. Building a digital infrastructure to help businesses, healthcare workers, first responders, and students. $100 billion to rebuild our crumbling schools. They talked about the need, the business community talked about the need to invest in HBCUs and community colleges. Retrofitting 4 million new buildings, or old buildings, retrofitting and making them new. Weatherizing 2 million homes. Building more climate-resilient cities and towns. These investments will specifically target communities of colors so we can break the cycle where in good times they lag, and in bad times they get hit first and the hardest. And in recovery, it's the toughest to bounce back. These are the kinds of investments that are going to strengthen our economy and our competitiveness, create millions of jobs, union jobs. And in doing so, we'll respect the dignity of work and empower the voice of workers. You've heard me say it before. My dad, when he lost his job in Scranton, eventually moved to Wilmington and got a good job. He'd say, Joey, a job's about a lot more than a paycheck. It's about your dignity, respect, your place in the community. It's about being able to look your kid in the eye and say, honey, everything's going to be okay. When we build back better, we'll do so with higher wages, including a $15 minimum wage nationwide, better benefits, stronger collective bargaining rights that you can raise a family on. That's how we build back the middle class better than ever. That's how we make sure workers are treated with the dignity and respect they deserve. I can go on. I can tell I was very encouraged by our conversation. But the point is this. There's so much we can do. The only way we do any of this is if we work together. I know we can do this. For example, on the call, I made it clear to the corporate leaders. I said, I want you to know I'm a union guy. Unions are going to have increased power. They just nodded. They understand. It's not anti-business. It's about economic growth, creating good-paying jobs. 11 years ago, when Barack and I took office during the Great Recession and implemented the Recovery Act that saved us from another Great Depression, we didn't see a map in red and blue states. It was the United States of America. We didn't care whether the city had voted for us or against us. The state voted for us or against us. We worked with everyone, and we recovered and rebuilt together as one nation. We can do this again. The refusal of Democrats and Republicans to cooperate with one another is not due to some mysterious force beyond our control. It's a conscious decision. It's a choice that we make. If we can decide not to cooperate, then we can decide to cooperate. I believe this is in part the mandate from the American people, part of the mandate they gave us. They want us to cooperate. They want us to deliver results. And the choice that Kamala and I will make is that we're going to do that. That's why I'm so pleased today we were able to bring together business and labor leaders to make the choice jointly with us. We're all Americans. Now let's get to work. As I've said many times, thank you, may God bless you, and may God protect our troops. I understand now I'm going to take some questions. Megan, fire away.
Thank you, President-elect Biden, Vice President-elect.
Looking in the wrong direction, sorry.
Good to see you. I want to start with a question about your pandemic planning and then a question about your economic plan. You spoke about the need to access the outgoing administration's COVID vaccine distribution plans. What do you see as the biggest threat to your transition right now, given President Trump's unprecedented attempt to obstruct and delay a smooth transfer of power?
More people may die if we don't coordinate. Look. As my chief of staff, Ron Klain, would say, who handled Ebola, the vaccine is important. It's of little use until you're vaccinated. So how do we get the vaccine? How do we get over 300 million Americans vaccinated? What's the game plan? It's a huge, huge, huge undertaking to get it done, prioritize those greatest in need, and working our way through it, and also cooperate with the World Health Organization and the rest of the world in dealing with this. And so they say they have this Warp Speed program that not only dealt with getting vaccines, but also how to distribute this. If we have to wait until January 20th to start that planning, it puts us behind over a month, month and a half. And so it's important that it be done, that there be coordination now. Now or as rapidly as we can get that done.
On the economy, the Vice President-elect talked about having an economy that works for working people. One thing I didn't hear you talk specifically about is canceling student loan debt. Does student loan forgiveness figure in your plan? Would you take executive action to achieve it?
It does figure in my plan. I've laid out in detail. For example, the legislation passed by the Democratic House calls for immediate $10,000 forgiveness of student loans. It's holding people up. They're in real trouble. They're having to make choices between paying their student loan and paying their rent, those kinds of decisions. It should be done immediately. In addition to that, if you know, I think that everything from community college straight through to doubling Pell Grants to making sure that we have access, free education for anyone making under $125,000 for 4 years of college. And there is a program that exists now under the law that forgives student loans for being able to engage in public service. I'm going to institute that fundamental change in that so it's able to be available to everyone that, in fact, is engaged. It's not being very well managed right now. So I'm going to do all of those things. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. President-elect. You just spoke of some of the dangers of the president's continued stonewalling of this transition, but it doesn't appear that the president is going to come around anytime soon and admit defeat. So what are you going to do? What options do you have to try and ensure that you are ready to go on day one?
Deal with every individual organization in the country, from business to labor, Republicans and Democrats, to try to pull together a serious and consistent plan. So we're ready on day one, everything from staffing to ultimately naming cabinet members to moving along on coordinating with business and labor the COVID attack, how we're going to attack COVID. So it would make it a lot easier if the president were to participate. You have a number of Republicans suggesting that. The good news here is my colleague is still in the Intelligence Committee, so she gets the intelligence briefings. I don't anymore. But there's a number of Republicans calling for that. I am hopeful that the president will be mildly more enlightened before we get to January 20th.
And what is your message to Republicans who are backing up the president's refusal to concede? You clearly need to work with them going forward.
My message is I will work with you. I understand a lot of your reluctance because of the way the president operates, but I've been in contact with them and will be in contact with more of them as we move along. And if it has to wait until January 20th to get actually become operational, that's a shame, but maybe that's the only way to get it done. Thank you very much, Mary.
Thank you very much, Mr. President-elect. I want to kind of piggyback off of that. I want to get your thoughts on the president's tweet over the weekend where he first seemed to acknowledge that you won, then he said he won't concede, then he said I won. How did you interpret that? And at the end of the day, do you want him to concede?
I interpret that as Trumpism. No change in his modus operandi. I think the pressure will continue to build. Look, I'm having a lot of meetings with world leaders on the telephone. I cannot get into negotiating with them about things that are going to be done, but they're calling with some degree of enthusiasm. Everyone from the Holy Father to prime ministers across the globe. So we're moving along knowing what the outcome will be. As I said earlier, and I probably shouldn't repeat it, but I find this more embarrassing for the country than debilitating for my ability to get started.
And then secondly, I want to follow up with you on the vaccine. If the FDA gives emergency authorization to the Pfizer or Moderna vaccine in the coming weeks, will you get vaccinated? And if you're hesitant, why should any American have confidence in the vaccine?
Well, first of all, we'll see if that comes forward. And secondly, it's important that people who are in the greatest need get it. I wouldn't hesitate to get the vaccine. But I also want to set an example. But I wouldn't hesitate to get the vaccine if, in fact, Dr. Fauci and these two organizations, whether it's Moderna or Pfizer, who have been extremely responsible, conclude that it is safe and able to be done. Look, the only reason people question the vaccine now is because of Donald Trump. That's the reason why people are questioning the vaccine, because all of the things he says and doesn't say, whether it's truthful, is it not truthful, the exaggerations. I think we're on a clear path now. We're on a clear path where the international community and national leaders in the scientific community have focused on these two vaccines. They appear to be ready for prime time, ready to be used. And if that continues along those roads, I would take the vaccine.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. President-elect. You have been urging the American public to continue practicing social distancing and wearing a mask, but with cases skyrocketing across the country, do you think that more governors should be closing non-essential businesses and reinstating stay-at-home orders?
Look, it depends on the state. What I failed to mention earlier is the enormous respect I have for conservative Republican governors who stepped up and issued mandates for wearing masks in North Dakota. One of the leaders in this area has been the Republican governor in Ohio. In addition to the folks who've already been leading, like the governor of Michigan. The idea that presidents now existing, remaining advisor on COVID is saying that they should resist. What the hell's the matter with these guys? What is the matter with them? Resist. And, every major individual of any consequence in the health field is saying we can save 100,000 lives just between now and January 21st by wearing these masks. It's going to take a while for the vaccine to be able to be available, distributed, and get to people. We're talking about 350 to 400,000 people dying? What are they doing? It's totally irresponsible. Irresponsible. And so I compliment the governors who stepped forward, who have been stepping forward, but also the Republican governors who stepped forward. I left out the governor of Utah, very conservative state, governor of North Dakota, and all the Democratic governors have been doing it all along. I just ask a rhetorical question. Do you guys understand this? Does anybody understand why a governor would turn this into a political statement? It's about patriotism. It's about being patriotic. It's about saving lives, for real. This is not hyperbole. It's about being patriotic. And I think you're seeing more and more, as this god-awful virus continues to spread almost unabated, that that governors are stepping up.
And just following up on that, especially with many states reporting new highs in terms of the daily number of cases and a lot of public health officials sounding the alarm over the holidays, what is your message to people who are considering, for example, getting together with their families and others for Thanksgiving? Would you urge people to reconsider their plans?
Well, here's what I'd do. Let me tell you what the health experts have said to me. And it's not because I'm unique and president-elect, it's because of my family. They strongly urge that if, in fact, we're going to have Thanksgiving with anyone, that we limit it to a maximum. They suggest 5 people, maximum 10 people, socially distanced, wearing masks, and people who have quarantined. So Jill and I spent this morning, like many of you, trying to figure out what are we going to do for Thanksgiving? How are we going to do it? And we've narrowed down which family members, and that they were tested, recently tested, within 24 hours. And so I would strongly urge, for the sake, not just your sake, for the sake of your children, your mother, your father, your sisters, your brothers, whoever you get together for Thanksgiving, think about this. There should be no group more than 10 people in one room. Inside the homes. That's what they're telling me. They're telling me, they're making sure that that's the case. And I have the more potent mask behind this one. I took it off when I came out here. I wear it inside this. That to be masked. It saves lives. And so, look, I just want to make sure that we're able to be together next Thanksgiving, next Christmas. I mean, it is an international crisis. It's an international health crisis. And the idea, we're at war with the virus. And it is, we're at war, for real. And all kidding aside, I hope all of you, I've watched you all, you all seem to wear masks all the time when you're, and the group that follows me, that is here, follows me, that is assigned to Delaware with me, seem to do that. I strongly urge you to do it. There's nothing macho about not wearing a mask.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. President-elect, Madam Vice President-elect. Your plan, oh, my mask is stuck in my earring. Demonstrating
for
America.
I watched Jill try to take it off. Yes. It's hard. I don't have an earring.
Your plan that you've outlined just now, about 1 million union jobs, clean energy jobs, investments in HBCUs, those are things that take time. We have a problem with long-term unemployment that's growing fast right now. What would you do right away, specifically, to address jobs that may not return for months, may not return ever, including in communities of color?
What I would do, I would pass the HEROES Act. It has all the money and capacity to take care of each of those things. Now. Now. Not tomorrow. Now. And the idea the president is still playing golf and not doing anything about it is beyond my comprehension. You'd at least think he'd want to go off on a positive note. But what is he doing? And there's virtually no discussion. And the Republicans, we're told, I don't know if that's true. You may know, Senator, but there's 22 Republicans say they won't vote for anything. Well, there ought to be at least a dozen of them have the courage to stand up and save lives and jobs now. We should be doing it now, keeping those businesses open, providing the PPE, the protective equipment, as well as the PPP, the money that we allow people to get funding to keep their businesses open, everything from separation to testing to a whole range of things that allow businesses to open and stay open. That's what the plan was at the beginning. And by the way, if you notice in the very beginning, when they passed the stimulus program, the first two pieces, what happened? Businesses were staying open. And then when they weren't open, they were still able to make people able to get paid. But look where they are now. People are running out of unemployment insurance. What are they going to do? 20 million people are on the verge of losing their home because they can't make a mortgage payments. You have a larger number being kicked out and will be kicked out on the street because they can't pay their rent. And by the way, it's not just the renter. It's the outfit that owns the building. A lot of them aren't multimillionaires. They're running small operations. How can they do it? This is about keeping Americans afloat. Get them through this pandemic. Get them through where they're still, their businesses are able to come back. The money's there. The money is there.
And also on the economic front, as we fight the pandemic, world trade continues, and there is great debate over world trade agreements, international trade agreements. It seems that in the last couple of days, 15 countries, Asian Pacific countries, have signed onto a new trade deal, the RCEP. Should the United States consider joining that trade agreement?
I've talked with a number of these world leaders, and I told them, under the law, I'm not able to begin to discuss with them. There's only one president at a time. As to who can say what our policy will be. So I'm reluctant to answer that question now, but here's what I can say. We make up 25% of the world's trading capacity of the economy of the world. We need to be aligned with the other democracies, another 25% or more, so that we can set the rules of the road instead of having China and others dictate outcomes because they are the only game in town. And so, but what I'm insisting on, and what I've been asked by world leaders as to what I would do, without getting into detail, I've said, but I want you to know, that there are three things going to happen if I'm elected. One, we're going to invest in American workers and make them more competitive. Number two, we're going to make sure that labor is at the table and environmentalists are at the table in any trade deals we make. And I'm not looking for punitive trade. The idea that we are poking our finger in the eyes of our friends and embracing autocrats makes no sense to me. And so, but I'm reluctant to get in more detail at this moment. I promise you I have a pretty thorough plan, and I will be prepared to announce that to you on January 21st.
You have indicated changes you want to make in U.S. international policy on other fronts, like the Paris climate.
Yes, that's a generic notion of rejoining, but I didn't get into the detail of what we'll do in that agreement. The same thing with rejoining the World Health Organization.
Why not here?
Because you're asking me about whether I join a specific proposal, the details of which are now only being negotiated among those nations. It would require a negotiation.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.